This is the Building Talks Net Zero podcast. I'm Chloe McCulloch, Buildings Editor, and I'm here with...
Me, Elizabeth Hopkirk. I'm Assistant Editor on Building's sister title, Building Design.
Construction can help save the planet. It already has the knowledge and much of the technology that can set us on the path to net zero. Building Talks Net Zero focuses on the people with the positive ideas and technical know-how that can help the built environment reach its carbon goals. So Elizabeth, tell us all about what's happening in this second episode.
We'll be joined again by Building's regular blogger on all things net zero, Simon Wyatt, who's a partner at Cundall. For this series, he's acting as our net zero jargon buster. He reveals the phrases that confuse rather than clarify. And this week, he's going to take on some financial jargon.
But before that, we will have a really interesting chat with two of the people behind LETI, which, if you don't know, is short for the London Energy Transformation Initiative. We find out what drives them and how they've managed to have such an impact so quickly. So, that's all coming up on the Building Talks Net Zero podcast. Welcome to our listeners. Last week, we were opposite St Paul's at Cundall's offices. This week, we're in Whitechapel.
That's right, Chloe. Yes, we're at 10 Whitechapel High Street. It's a 1980s office building, a solid granite facades, really big building, the kind of thing that's being knocked down a lot at the moment. But it's a great example of what we should be doing instead of knocking buildings down. In 2016, Fletcher Priest and Derwent gave it a very major repurposing. They recycled much of the original building material, they reused the services, they repurposed the fixtures and fittings. They essentially extended its life, and I think you probably felt the same as I did when we walked in. It's a really lovely space with a huge atrium and a cafe and views out.
It's a lovely feel when you come in. I noticed the G-plan furniture actually, but then I looked up and I was like, wow, that's a huge atrium. And then you come through, and then yeah, we're in Elemental's offices. And it's just a really nice space. So yeah, it's really good to be here, and it's really good to be in a building that is a perfect exemplar, I suppose, of what a lot of this podcast is about, which is about retrofitting, refurbishing, rather than knocking down and demolishing and trying to keep in all of that embodied carbon.
Absolutely right.
Okay, so let's get started with some net zero news. So, Elizabeth, this episode coincides neatly with the very start of COP26. How did we do that? That's good timing. And just to, I suppose, bring up some recent headlines that came in the run-up to COP26, which I suppose was slightly worrying when the Prime Minister sort of was dampening down expectations by saying, I think to a group of children, that it was touch and go as to whether the UK will broker deals that are going to be good enough to stop irreversible climate change, which I suppose was a bit of a wake-up call as to what's at stake over the coming 2 weeks.
That's right. And the UN also issued that report on the eve of COP, saying that if we carry on as we are with the plans that we've been saying are great, we're actually heading towards catastrophic climate warming and of 2.7 degrees. So yeah, not a great start.
Yeah, you do get regular reports like that out, but I suppose this one did hit home a bit because it was saying, you know, nations have put forward their plans and they're hoping to hit these targets. But as it stands, yeah, we're well over what we should be hitting. Other news, I suppose the big news was from last week was the budget and the autumn spending review. Much anticipated, but quite criticised in terms of the net zero agenda. So I know that the Chancellor came in for some flack over tax breaks for unsustainable transport. Did you pick up on that, Elizabeth?
That's right. That's not a good look just before COP, is it?
Yeah. So the tax breaks were, I mean, freezing of fuel duty, which we sort of come to expect every year, but then cutting of passenger duty on internal UK flights.
It seems really off key, doesn't it? In fact, Simon Alford, who we spoke to last week, who's the new president of the RIBA, said Sunak's message felt out of sync with the long-term challenges that the country faces And Julie Hirigoyen from the Green Building Council said something quite similar. I think a little bit tougher. She said, "What planet is he on?"
It wasn't that it was without some good kind of giveaways. So I think there were changes to business rates to incentivize investment in renewable technology, but it's a bit piecemeal, I think, was the feedback. And there isn't this sort of bigger picture, this bigger strategy. We talked about this in the last episode. The heat and building strategy had quite a lot of gaps to fill, and people were really hoping that the Chancellor would fill those with something like funding for a national retrofit program. Not a sign of that anywhere.
Nothing. No, nada.
But, you know, there was money for new research and development funding. There were grants for local authorities. So it wasn't without some merit, but I think in the net zero space, I think the feedback is it wasn't enough and it's not going to get us there.
That's right. Yeah, I think a lot of disappointment in the industry and certainly among the architects that I've spoken to.
Yeah.
Did you read that piece by Thomas Lane, our colleague in building? He did a really in-depth look at the heat and building strategy. He's not very impressed, is he?
No, well, Tom's really good at getting stuck into the detail of these things. So give him a strategy and he will read through it line by line, which is exactly what he did. I definitely recommend Tom's article as a read, and you'll find that on building.co.uk. This is the Building Talks Net Zero podcast. I'm Chloe McCulloch and I'm with Elizabeth Hopkirk. So Elizabeth, let's move on to our main interview for this week. Who are we talking to?
Well, Chloe, we've got two guests with us here this week. We've got Clara Bagnall-George, who's an associate at Elementa Consulting, and Julie Godfrey, who's SIBSE's head of sustainability and a sustainability consultant. They're both leading lights behind LETI, which you mentioned before, the London Energy Transformation Initiative. And LETI, as you know, won the Architect of the Year Award, Leadership Award. And everyone I spoke to in the room at the AYAs was just thrilled because I think everyone has good things to say about what LETI's been up to. Clara, can I start with you? Can you tell us what LETI is for anyone who doesn't know?
We're a group of built environment professionals that have been working together for about 4.5 years that are looking to move the kind of built environment in the UK towards zero carbon.
And you've been going only since, I think, 2016, and you've had extraordinary impact already. I mean, everyone's talking about you. What's the secret?
I guess we're really organic, and we've grown over time depending on what people were interested in doing, what people thought, what kind of gaps needed filling. There wasn't really a direction. It's really kind of fast paced and collaborative.
Let's just rewind a little bit back to perhaps just before 2016. How did it all come about?
I suppose I'd become an engineer because I thought this is how I could make the biggest impact in terms of mitigating climate change impacts. And I was kind of doing energy strategies in London and trying to kind of work on projects and drive down carbon emission reductions. And there were certain strange things in the policy that, you know, although when the policy was first put in place, they were really driving those carbon emission reductions. But then, from that time and moving forward, they weren't really driving the carbon emission reductions that they should have been because of the kind of change in energy landscape. And that was a bit frustrating that, you know, I'd chosen this career because I wanted to drive change, but the policy that was meant to be pushing change was actually holding back change.
Which particular policy are we talking about?
Oh gosh, it's very detailed and techy.
Okay,
and it's
to do with just give me the title.
It's to do with gas. It's to do with gas CHP, and to do with carbon factors of the grid and the fact that they hadn't been updated, and so that meant that certain technologies looked like they were reducing carbon, but because the grid had decarbonised a lot for the 5 years before that, it meant that different technologies were then coming forward and looking and actually reducing carbon, but that wasn't incentivized within the policy.
And that specifically in the London area?
I mean, it's relevant to the UK, but because London is pushing more and driving harder, that actually meant perversely that because it was driving more, it was driving more in the wrong direction because the direction had changed.
Okay, because that kind of points to, I guess, the name, you're the London Energy Transformation Initiative.
I know.
And I just wondered why you've got that London focus.
Yeah, and we all regret that now because it becomes so big. But at the time, naming ourselves London Energy Transformation Initiative seemed like a big thing to try and be, you know. So, yeah, we the group of us that started SE are all based in London, and that was what that started the conversations. So the first things that happened was I then started doing talks about it, writing articles about it, posting on LinkedIn, trying to start those conversations. And then also just straight away talking to the policymakers at the GLA about it and talk them through our kind of thoughts. And they said, yeah, we know, we understand, the landscape has changed, and we want to address it. And I said, great, can we support that? And they said, yeah. And then over the kind of a couple of months, we were building some momentum, and I thought, well, let's hold a big workshop. And I remember my boss at the time saying, you're not going to get more than 30 people to spend half a day on this. You know, we had over 150 people want to come. And from that, and then the only output that we wanted originally from that was to create a kind of a document that said, this is what we think needs to change. And then we realised we can't expect the GLA to change their policy based on somebody saying this is something that needs to be done. You know, so then we started developing robust, more robust information about all our recommendations.
Julie, do you want to come in at this point? Julie Godfrey.
Yeah, I distinctly remember that workshop. So I wasn't at CIBSE yet, and I just left my job. But the one of the last projects I had done was actually for the GLA on changing basically a recommendations report on that very policy that was problematic. Mm-hmm. And as part of that, I had done a lot of interviews. And you could see that many people were frustrated. But all we managed to get was all these interviews to be an appendix to the recommendations report. And then there was this invite to the workshop. And part of me thought, another workshop where everybody's going to complain about that policy, you know, because everybody was frustrated. But there was something more positive somehow in the invite or in the way that people presented it and things. And definitely at the workshop, it was just positive. It wasn't a long rant by the consultants. So I think that really changed things. Very often you go to, you know, roundtables and workshops and da-da-da, and nothing happens. And I had almost assumed this would happen. And I remember when the follow-up emails arrived, I was like, oh, that's different. We're actually going to follow up on that. So that was very positive from the start. And I think, I mean, that's clearly Clara's drive. She always thinks about the next step and how to get an impact.
It's listening to people. I think what really helped was that I was relatively junior when we started Leti, and it was just about being a sponge and listening to other people and not having the agenda. Like, I had that agenda of that specific policy, but it was more like, that's something that I'm bringing to the table, but I'm wanting to learn from others. And I think the acknowledgement that what Leti does, you're not going to 100% agree with, was something that we discussed quite at the beginning. You want to be comfortable with 70% of what's in the documents, and then it's okay. You know, because this document is collaborative, it's bringing lots of voices in. It's and you've got to be comfortable with that. But Leti only exists because there's a gap, right? We're all volunteers, and we really try to use that voluntary resource in the most effective way possible. So ideally, Leti wouldn't exist, you know, because we'd have all of the answers and we'd know what we're doing. It only exists because we don't, and because Leti provides that way of collaborating across disciplines, across competitive organisations, to define good, to make clear what we need to do and to learn from each other.
You're quite a young person yourself, Clara. Can we ask how old you are?
Yeah, I'm 30.
You're the generation that's going to be, you know, you're inheriting the earth from the generation above that's messed it up. Does that leave you feeling kind of angry, or are you feeling hopeful because of what we just discussed?
I think I'm so lucky because we have Leti, and I just focus on the positivity of what we're trying to do all together, and that I don't go in the dark corner of despair because I'm focusing on positivity and solutions. I'm not going to worry about what everybody else is doing, but I can focus on buildings and my own personal lifestyle, and be joyful with the connections and the groups that we're doing, and the positive attitude and driving things forward.
Could you give us perhaps three takeaway points for people who are wanting to reduce the carbon impact of the buildings that they're designing?
Yeah, I think the first one is quite basic, but it's get fossil fuels out of the building and work towards a solution that doesn't involve burning fossil fuels. I suppose number two would be about targets and understanding where you're at. You know, at Leti, we've set energy use targets in kilowatt hours a meter squared. And so for buildings that you live in, you design, you've built, actually from the energy bills, you can easily understand what the energy consumption of that building is and see how far away that is from the Leti target that meets net zero. Understand the journey that you need to take and then start to reorientate yourself and work out on the project that you're currently working in. Don't wait for the next one, the one you're actually doing now. What's it going to be? And is that enough? And can you reduce that even further and start learning about how you're going to get to that target? And as well as the operational energy, we need to think about embodied carbon. That's part of the story too. And so I'd really encourage you to understand the embodied carbon impact of the buildings that you're working on.
And the third thing, again, it's pretty basic, but it's to check what has actually been achieved. And again, it's... I think there's really a big realization now that it's not about only the definition and the target and the ambition, but what do our buildings actually consume? What did we think the embodied carbon was going to be? And what has actually been built? Where did materials come from? Were there any changes that mean that actually is higher carbon than we thought?
We haven't actually asked you very much about yourselves yet. Julie, do you want to tell us kind of who you are now and where you've come from on this journey?
So I'm an engineer, and I always cared about the environment, but I was very badly signposted when I was a student, because when I said I'm good at science and I care about the environment, they just talked to me about water pollution and nuclear. And I thought, well, I'm going to get, you know, buy myself some time to work out what I do like. I did a PhD in low carbon technologies and low carbon buildings. And as part of that, I was extremely lucky because the technology I was studying, so a CHP unit as it happens, was installed in the building. So I tried to understand how first the CHP was working or not working, and then how the building was working. And I was hooked.
And Clara, what about you? Where are you now and where have you come from?
I guess this journey started from me. I went to a non-conformist, like vegetarian self-governing school. So that's my background. And I think that's really kind of shaped who I've become. You know, when I was 14, I was campaigning to ban single-use plastic bags in Letchworth. Yeah, and then I've been campaigning with Greenpeace and People and Planet and various groups, Citizens UK. And then I've had my kind of professional career where I was really into, I don't know, into big things and how they connect, and into sculpture and 3D. And I thought architecture was what I was interested in, which is why I did this course at Nottingham. And then a kind of few years into being a professional and looking at energy systems and planning statements, kind of realised I hit this thing where I was like, oh, I was about to start doing the illegal activism stuff. And I thought, do I want to be doing that? And then I thought, what about if I work within my professional system to try and make change from within and collaborate with policymakers? Could that work?
And so would you recommend for the next generation who are coming up, who are considering their career options, but also like looking at the state of the planet and possibly being in that slight, you know, pit of despair moment, what would you say to that generation?
Don't be afraid of hierarchy. I've always ignored it. And ask people directly how you can collaborate and how you can change and what they think, you know. I don't think people should be afraid of going to the people who are making the policy, the people who are making the regulations, the managing director of a company, and just saying, I think this is a bit wrong, and do you want to have a conversation about it?
Do the doors just open?
I think if you knock at the door, and if you smile and if you're kind, people want to open it.
That's brilliant. That's really helpful practical advice. And if people want more, where should they look?
Oh, this is the plug. www.leti.london.
Brilliant. Thank you.
That was a really nice interview, Elizabeth.
It was really interesting, wasn't it? And I think one of the things I enjoyed was hearing a bit about them as people and the story behind Leti, the kind of human stories. There's an awful lot of kind of organisations with acronyms, and it's easy to get confused, but the passion was, well, tangible, wasn't it?
I think so, and I think if you hear from the people rather than thinking about, like you say, the acronyms, it just brings it alive a bit more. And because there is so much technical stuff to get your head around, you can sometimes lose the not the point of it, but there's a lot of policy, there's a lot of technical jargon which we try to unpack in this podcast. But I think to get to the actual people and the issues and their motivations and why they do what they do, that's just really nice to hear. And now for Simon Wyatt at Cundall for our regular net zero jargon buster session. Simon focuses on net zero finance this week. This is a massive topic to try to cover in a short space of time, and Simon's way in is to look at the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure. It's one hell of a mouthful, and most of us have never heard of it. So what does it mean, and why is it important?
Yeah, so as we discussed last week, one of the largest drivers we're seeing around the net zero carbon agenda is coming from the financial institutions and financial markets. And the main driver there is something called the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, or TCFD, which was set up by the Bank of England and Mark Carney, endorsed by pretty much all world banks, and is starting to require organisations to look at their climate risk and mitigation strategies. So it's really broken into two areas. One of them is mitigation, which we covered quite a lot last week, which looks at how you reduce your carbon footprint to net zero carbon in accordance with science-based targets. The other area, which is probably less understood, is around climate risk and resilience. So that's looking at how your business or organisation is set up to deal with a changing climate and changing world. Most of us design buildings and supply chain systems based on historic data, and these are now being proven to be out of date. We've seen 1.2 degrees of climate change. And we're set to see at least another 0.3, more likely closer to towards 2 degrees of climate change overall. And these are going to have profound impacts on the way we live and operate our lives. We've obviously seen that heavily over the last few years.
You're talking about the fires, the forest fires, and the terrible flooding that we've seen, are you?
Yeah, so the last 2 years has been a real wake-up call. I think people thought that climate change was going to happen somewhere else in developing nations, whereas the last 2 years we've obviously saw the tropical storms in the Caribbean, which was really intense a couple of years ago, significant damage. And then over the last 2 years we've just seen forest fire on forest fire. We saw the devastating effect on Australia. North America's had significant forest fires this year. Canada had new natural phenomena in terms of climate change, where they're basically getting superheated bubbles which don't move because of climate change, and that's causing significant damage and releasing more carbon into the atmosphere. And obviously in Europe we're seeing significant flash flooding. We saw the horrendous floodings in Germany and Central Europe. And these things are just becoming more and more likely. If you look at data in terms of extreme weather events, they're happening more and more frequently, and that's being linked to the changing climate.
So practically, what should built environment professionals be doing about it?
Well, it's understanding risk. It's a risk profile. So what the requirements of TCFD is to look at a risk analysis of a business. I mean, you can do that for a project or you can do it for a built environment organisation. So it's understanding your risk to an asset or it's the supply chains associated with that. So one of the main things is if you're building a new building, it's looking at the conditions the buildings have to operate in. So residential, it's looking at things like overheating. So we generally design using historic weather data, so the buildings we're designing for aren't designed to deal with 1.1 or 1.2 degrees of climate change, and in 50 years time they could be dealing with 2 degrees of climate change, so they're going to be significantly warmer. So we need to change our design conditions. And what we did at Cundall a few years ago was review a number of design conditions we use in the built environment and categorise them. So there's standards which are basically purely based on historic data, so it's out of date and not fit for purpose. There's others which use an allowance for climate change, but that's normally a finger in the air, it's not based on science. Then there are people that are starting to use the correct climate science, but that is evolving. So we've seen various versions. One of the best examples of that is overheating. So overheating is very good standards now from SIBSE to predict future conditions, and you can use future weather files for that. But those weather files are now out of date. They're not aligned to the latest climate science. They're being updated by SIBSE, but at the moment, everyone is designing buildings to those standards which aren't fit for purpose. And what we've seen is that all the climate projections are underestimates. Like when they've come out over the last decade, people have been accused of scaremongering. And what we've seen is that they're all underestimates. Everything that was predicted to happen at 2 degrees, we've already started to see happen now. We're seeing massive climate change. And most of the modelling doesn't take into account tipping points, things like the extreme bushfires triggering more carbon release. So there's lots of runaway climate change which is accelerating these predictions, and they're having to be updated. And again, we need to be taking those into account in our analysis.
Just on that SIBSE point, when are those updates due?
Well, they've only just got funding for it. So
right.
It was done originally by Exeter University, and they've just applied for funding, got funding, and they're going through a review. But that's looking at frequency analysis. But when you're looking at sizing things like cooling plant, there's still no clear guidance on what those peak temperatures are going to be at 2030, 2050. So what TCFD and climate risk analysis does is it makes people look at different projection scenarios. These are called RCPs. So RCPs are representative concentration pathways, and they're basically aligned. So there's basically an RCP at 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees, 3 degrees, 4 degrees. And what we should be looking to do is looking at the risks of those different scenarios. So if you're looking at designing a large infrastructure project like HS2, you want to look at the worst case. You want to be looking at a 4-degree world, designing the tracks so they don't buckle in those kind of temperatures.
Is that happening?
Yes, they've actually got quite a decent team looking at the climate risk and resilience. I don't know the full details, but I know that there's significant work's gone into that. Whereas if you're looking at, say, a building and you're looking at your cooling plant, you probably don't need to look out to RCP 8.6, the 4-degree. You probably want to look at a lower RCP and a lot shorter timescale, because you replace your cooling plant kind of every 25, 30 years. So you can look at the risk associated with those things. And again, when you're looking at designing flood risk and drainage, it's looking at the different scenarios. So if you're looking at 2 degrees and 3 degrees, what is the difference? How big a tank do you need? What's the difference in size of tank? How much is that going to cost? So it's risk-based profile. So if it's going to cost a lot of money and it's a low probability of happening, you might go for a lower RCP. Whereas if it's a higher risk but it doesn't cost that much to do, you might design for kind of the worst case situation. So it's really looking at every design condition and thing and saying, what is the risk and how do we mitigate that risk going forward?
Is there an implication for existing buildings?
Again, it's what we've seen in the media over the last couple of years. So again, people are looking at flood risk more in detail. So old flood risk assessments are very much focused on river flooding, zone 1, 2, 3, whereas a lot of the future projections is about intense rainfall, which we've obviously seen over the last couple of years, where you get a very short, sharp downpour of rain. So you can actually start to predict that. So the government released something called the 2.2-kilometre project last year with the Met Office, and that looked at very small grids of the UK using climate change projection scenarios. So you could actually forecast and predict some of the extreme weather events we've seen. And as I said earlier, some people for SUDS design have been adding 30 or 40% on as a finger in the air. What we've seen is it's very disparate across the country. Some areas can see 20, 30%, but some concentrated valleys could see 200, 300%. So it's really looking at that individual place and understanding the risk. Where we're looking outside the UK, it's even more extreme. So looking in places like Hong Kong, where you've got typhoons, severe tropical storms, then areas of cities become regularly attacked by cyclones and these influences. And therefore, you know your insurance premiums are going to start to go up. So again, where it's being used in places like Hong Kong, people are actually starting to move out of areas of cities because they know they're going to be hardest hit and the insurance premiums are likely to go up. So again, it's using the data and the climate science to understand what's going to happen in the future and de-risk your businesses. The UK government, the Committee for Climate Change wrote their guidance recently for the UK government on the UK adaptation strategy. And we've obviously seen the Environment Agency, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, come out and say that the UK is not ready to deal with climate change and we need to act now. And the way we act is by risk-based analysis.
So just to leave our listeners with one piece of advice, if you've never heard of this task force before, you should check it out and look at a risk-based approach to looking at your business going forward.
Yeah, I think unless you're in finance, you don't really need to look at the Task Force for Financial Disclosure. But the main lesson is to really think about climate risk. We know that the world is changing. We know that we need to design and adapt to it. So again, it's really thinking about appropriate solutions, not just for the current climate, but for the climate we've caused.
Thank you so much, Simon. That was really informative as ever. Well, if you didn't know anything about net zero finance before, you do now.
Yes, some real detail to get your teeth into. But I guess the overall message is that financial institutions are starting to really focus on risk and mitigation. And if businesses are not talking the same language, they could really get caught out.
Yeah, it really underlines how important it is to look at the net zero agenda through a business lens, I think. So that's it for this week's Building Talks Net Zero podcast. We'll be back again next Monday with some reflections on the first week of COP26 and with some more guests lined up for you. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with the show or have any thoughts or opinions or reactions to the issues in this week's episode, please email us at newsdesk@building.co.uk or on Twitter at @buildingnews. So that's it from me, Chloe McCulloch and Elizabeth Hopkirk. Our podcast producer was Tarek Aziz. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening and goodbye.